The Force Field is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Listen to other great tech podcasts at www.techpodcasts.com.
From Charlotte, North Carolina, for IT service providers, it's The Force Field with Rick Savoia. And now, here is your host, Rick Savoia.
Greetings, providers. Welcome to the unofficial podcast for IT service providers, The Force Field. I am your host, Rick Savoia, and during the next half hour, we'll cover the news, views, reviews, and interviews for and about the IT industry and the Force Field community. Our call-in segment is open to all listeners Saturday nights from 10:30 p.m. to 2 a.m. Eastern. Call 407-278-5698. That's 407-278-5698. Or you can call in via Skype at Savoia Computer if you would like to be part of the show. At some point in the history of nearly every business, the question is ultimately asked, should I accept credit cards? I hear this question from time to time in various forums and news groups, and it's one that needs to be carefully considered before a decision is made. There's a lot to consider. I made the decision early on in my business to accept credit cards based on several factors. First, other computer stores accepted them, and I wanted to keep up with my competitors. Second, I sold computers, which in 1997 were still big-ticket items and were generally products a lot of my potential customers cannot always afford to pay for in cash. Third, I wanted to have a payment option that would avoid net terms and minimize the number of outstanding accounts. Finally, I wanted to give my customers the convenience of alternate payment options and make it easier for them to pay up front. For the most part, my merchant account did provide these benefits. However, it came at a cost I was not prepared for, and with a responsibility I didn't expect. So, yes, accepting credit cards in your business is a question to consider. But there are caveats. There are risks involved. There are things about accepting plastic that credit card processing companies don't tell you in the sales pitches, and a few things about the credit card business that they don't want you to know. This week, we're going to talk with an IT professional and merchant who learned these things on his own and created an online resource to inform businesses everywhere about both the rewards and risks of accepting credit cards. But first, let's take a look at what's going on elsewhere in the IT industry. The OpenOffice.org community officially announced the release of OpenOffice.org 3.0 to the public October 13th. OpenOffice.org 3.0 is the latest release of the open-source office suite originally developed by Sun Microsystems and is considered by many to be one of few serious competitors of Microsoft Office. During the initial launch, the OpenOffice.org official website went down. A source at Sun was quoted as saying that the outage was due to a large number of HTTP requests bombarding the site. The high number of requests was believed to be attributed to a sudden increase in traffic in response to the official release of OpenOffice.org 3.0. OpenOffice.org 3.0 reached 3 million downloads in its first week of release. The Office Suite is released under the new GPL and is freely available. OpenOffice.org version 3.0 is currently available for download in English for Windows, Linux, OS X, and OpenSolaris at www.openoffice.org. We are constantly adding new content and links to resources on theforcefield.net to help you start and grow your IT business. To keep you informed of all the latest on theforcefield.net, we just launched the Force Field Insider, a weekly newsletter with news headlines, commentary, and other updates from the Force Field podcast and portal. Features include the latest tech news headlines, links to the latest blog posts and comments in the Force Field, new product notifications and reviews, updates to the IT Business Resource Directory, links to the latest episodes of the Force Field podcast, behind-the-scenes production reports of the show, previews of upcoming episodes, contests and incentives, vendor promotions, and more. To subscribe, simply go to theforcefield.net, fill out the short form in the left sidebar, and click Subscribe. It's that easy. Best of all, it's free, and you can't beat free. Subscribe to the Force Field Insider newsletter today and get the latest from inside the Force Field. Windows 7, the code name for the next version of Microsoft Windows, has now been given an official name, Windows 7. In a post on the Windows Vista team blog October 13th, Mike Nash, Corporate Vice President of Windows Product Management, officially announced that the code name will now become the actual name of the new operating system, which is due for release sometime around the end of next year. Microsoft is also preparing to release another service pack for Windows Vista. Redmond is sending out a heads-up to beta testers that Microsoft Windows Vista Service Pack 2 Beta 1 is due for release October 29th. This will be the second service pack for Windows Vista prepared for release this year. It isn't really unusual for Microsoft to release two service packs so close together. Remember the early days of Windows NT 4? It's just been a while since they were on top of things like this. I guess we've become so accustomed to delays and heel-dragging when it comes to major product releases and updates that some of us are actually surprised when Microsoft picks up the pace. It's about time, too. Vista was launched way behind schedule and stripped of many key features initially promised simply because Microsoft ran out of time to fully develop them and meet their latest deadline, which had already been pushed back several times. It's my belief that this is the prime reason for Vista's troubles after its release. It simply wasn't ready for launch, and it showed. This is why I call Vista the new millennium. The look and feel of Windows ME was that of an operating system that was thrown together just so Microsoft could have something out there while it was wrapping up Windows XP. As soon as XP was launched, Millennium was given a quiet sweep under the rug. Now, I'm not saying that Vista will suffer the same fate, at least not to the extent of Millennium. Obviously, Microsoft is fully supporting the product, as evidenced by the release of Service Pack 2, which is two service packs more than it supported Millennium. This is likely because Microsoft invested a lot more in the development of Vista than it did with the forgotten one. However, it is becoming clear that Vista's days are numbered. Microsoft is hastening release of Windows 7, and Windows XP has been given yet another reprieve. To keep a 9-year-old operating system alive while prepping another one two generations after it is a bit unusual and indicates their lack of confidence in Vista to carry the torch until the next release. The latest operating system may be getting a second new service pack, but I get the strange feeling that as soon as Windows 7 is launched, there is a possibility that Vista will be sent into the horizon, never to be seen or heard from again. And that's the news in the Force Field. I am very particular about what goes in the Force Field, and I only promote products and services that I either use myself or would use if I needed them. This week I would like to introduce you to a new sponsor who I've been using myself for reliable web hosting to keep the Force Field online 24/7. GoDaddy.com. GoDaddy's hosting plans are bigger and better than ever with 99% uptime, free 24/7 support, and no annual commitment. If you want to make an impact online, GoDaddy.com has what you need. .com names as low as $1.99, plus world-class hosting, fast and easy website builders, and much more. Here's the best part. As a listener of the Force Field, enter the code BLU101 when you check out and save an additional 10% on your web hosting order. You want reliable web hosting at a great price? Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. Some restrictions apply, so see site for details. That's GoDaddy.com. You're listening to The Force Field, and this is the part of the show I look forward to the most, as it is the opportunity to talk to my fellow professionals in the field. If you'd like to talk, you can call me at 407-CPU-JOY-8. That's 407-278-5698, or through Skype at Savoya Computer. If you don't have Skype, simply go to the Force Field Podcast episodes page at theforcefield.net and click the Skype icon located on the right sidebar. The download is free, the call is free, and the show is free. And you can't beat free. So call in and dare to enter the Force Field. If you have ever applied for a business license, or have been in business for any length of time, chances are you have been bombarded with postcards in the mail and annoying phone calls from telemarketers pitching credit card merchant services. According to them, credit card transactions increase sales, are quick and easy to perform, and improve cash flow. But there's a lot more about setting up a credit card merchant account that they don't tell you, and a lot that they don't want you to know. It's important to know because it's what they don't tell you that can help you make the best decision as to which credit cards to accept, or whether to accept them at all. In 2001, IT professional and merchant Tom Mahoney launched a website to help small businesses learn the pros and cons of accepting credit cards and provide them with the resources to fight credit card fraud. This week we're going to talk to Tom, learn how his own experiences with fraudulent credit card transactions prompted him to create his website, discuss the benefits and risks of accepting credit cards in your business, and find out which credit cards are the best and worst to accept in part one of a two-part series on Merchant 911, Accepting Credit Cards. And we're speaking to Tom. Tom, welcome to the Force Field.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Rick.
First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, Tom.
Well, actually, I've been in fraud prevention now since 2001, and it's kind of a free time offshoot, Rick, from some of the things I've done in the past. I'm an ex-police officer. I spent about 7 years in the police force, and I've got 25 years experience with computer networking and the internet. And my wife and I have a website. Actually, we have three of them now. But back when we started in 2001, we had one website, and we got burned with a lot of chargebacks. And I saw a need for Merchant 911, and I got it started. So that's kind of my background, police work and also the internet.
How did the idea for Merchant 911 come about? Was it a particular incident?
Yes, actually, as I mentioned, my wife and I had a website in addition to a brick and mortar store. And back in late 2000, we had got about 17 chargebacks from our processor. And when these orders first came in, we had questioned them because we noticed that they were using United States issued credit cards, but they were all to be shipped to Serbia. And we questioned this. We actually went to the processor and we said, something's wrong with this. This doesn't look right. What should we do? And they said, well, you got an authorization on these cards, so it's fine to ship them. So we shipped this stuff, and a couple months later, the chargeback started coming in, and we lost about $1,200 worth of merchandise as a result.
Now, these were stolen cards?
Yes, these have been stolen cards from where we don't know. And so we kind of put the word out to a lot of other online merchants that we knew, and we found out that merchants were not aware that they had to do any kind of fraud screening. They were pretty much convinced that, once they got an authorization, that it was okay to ship the stuff. And that just isn't the case.
So really, it was a matter of trust between the merchant and the credit card companies and the credit card processing companies that the processing companies would do their jobs and screen all of this so that they were assured it was a safe transaction when it actually wasn't.
Well, yeah, that's the case. There is that level of trust there. But unfortunately, the processors and the credit card companies don't tell you that when you're dealing with e-commerce, you are always responsible for credit card fraud. And typically, they do not do any fraud screening at all. The card processing industry is about processing those transactions, getting as many of them done in a short amount of time as they can. And unless you are paying someone else to do any fraud screening, you're on your own.
Now, the reason we're discussing this on the Force Field today is because at some point in the establishment of every business, the question inevitably comes up, should I accept credit cards? And I hear this discussion a lot in various forums for IT pros who are currently in business or planning to get into it. Of course, the popular pitch from credit card processing companies is that unless you accept credit cards from your customers, you are losing potential sales and revenue. And obviously, when you purchase something online, there are a few other options, but what about brick-and-mortar offices and storefronts? I mean, given our dependency on plastic, is this really true, or is it just a hard sales pitch from these companies?
Well, I think it's actually a little bit of both, Rick, if you want to know the truth. Certainly, you do lose some sales if you do not accept credit cards. But on the other hand, there's a certain amount of risk. Our experience has been that the amount of sales that you lose are not going to be that great. And the risk with brick-and-mortar stores is very, very minimal because if the customer has that plastic in hand, you're almost guaranteed that you're going to get paid for that transaction. Of course, as we know, that's not the case online field. Mm-hmm. But we've done a lot of off-site kinds of things. We've done Native American powwows. We've done gift shows, that kind of thing. And early on, we were not able to accept credit cards when we were out there. And quite frankly, there was a very few that we lost, particularly if you're willing to take checks. And, you know, taking checks is probably a little bit more risky than accepting credit cards in a brick-and-mortar situation.
I'll agree there. I've been burned on accepting checks before. We are all aware of the pros and cons of buying with credit cards as customers in a store. What are the advantages of accepting credit cards for the merchants?
You're talking about brick and mortar?
Brick and mortar, on-site, e-commerce, whatever, merchants, period.
Okay, well, obviously there's a distinct advantage there because, as we mentioned before, you are going to lose a certain amount of sales. But that's particularly true with online sales, because obviously nobody can hand you cash when you're doing business over the internet. So there's very definite advantages to taking credit cards. And it's not as risky as you might think if you know all the ins and outs of accepting those transactions. But I think it's important for merchants to be aware that there are also other options besides simply taking credit cards.
Well, given the advantages, what are the disadvantages of taking these cards for merchants all the way around?
Well, the disadvantages, particularly in the online world, is that you are always responsible for credit card fraud. I don't care what the reason for that chargeback turns out to be, whether it's because the buyer claims that they didn't receive it or that it was not as it was promised or that they just didn't like it or changed their minds. You have two choices. You either have to refund their money or you have to receive a chargeback. And chargebacks can be very, very expensive.
Now, I take it when we get a chargeback, we are not only losing that money, we're also having to pay a fee for the chargeback itself. Is this whether or not we get the merchandise back?
Very frequently, that can be the case. A lot depends on your paper trails and the kinds of things that you're able to present to the credit card company if they do a request. Clearly, what we have found with Merchant 911, and I've got over 3,700 members' experience to draw from, you're never going to be able to prove to the satisfaction of the processor that you actually delivered merchandise, because even if you ship it with proof of delivery, they're not going to accept it because they're going to say, well, the person that signed for it wasn't the person that ordered it. or they're going to come up with any excuse they can, because quite frankly, and they deny it, but I have said it numerous times and I will continue to say it, they have a revenue stream from fraudulent transactions.
Because it pays them, they not only get their money back, but they also get the fees.
Yeah, that's correct, Rick. They typically, they get anywhere between $15 and $25 for every chargeback. And I have not done any recent numbers because I have not been able to find them anymore. They've kind of stopped putting those numbers out there for everybody to see. But in 2001, Visa alone collected over $555 million in chargeback fees alone.
That's quite a lot of money to get back on charges. So that is really a nice revenue stream, as you said. I guess that really does eliminate the incentive to side with the merchant. So the merchant really has a lot going against him here.
Yes, he does. Absolutely. And the merchant is going to pay for credit card fraud, whether it happens to him or not, because if he's going to prevent it, he's going to have to spend some kind of his revenue, whether it's in people hours or whether it's in actual funds to pay somebody else to do his screening for him. But it's absolutely critical that online merchants do some fraud screening, because nobody else does it for them.
Are there many cases, or any cases really, where chargebacks are decided in favor of the merchant?
There are some, Rick, but quite frankly, we have not heard of that many. Occasionally, the merchant will get lucky. A lot depends, actually, you know, on who he talks to when he talks to the issuing bank. Typically, the processors don't get involved in this. The chargebacks originate from the issuing bank, because the customer calls, the cardholder calls the bank and says, well, I didn't make this charge. And if, in fact, he did make the charge and the merchant is able to produce proof of delivery, a lot depends on who the guy is talking to. If he's talking to some minimum wage clerk in the bank, yeah, it could go either way. So there's no real hard and fast rules. The rules are set forth in the rules for merchants and in a lot of the rules and regulations that are issued by the credit card companies that unfortunately the merchant is never allowed to see. But a lot depends on how those rules happen to be interpreted at the moment.
So the bottom line is the merchant has to keep detailed paperwork and accounts and a trail of every transaction, yet in the end, no matter how diligent the merchant is at this, there are still no guarantees that it will work in his favor.
That's absolutely right, Rick. And, you know, the online merchant, if he takes that loss, he's actually going to take a triple hit, because he's going to lose his merchandise. He's going to lose the money that he made on that merchandise, plus any shipping fees that he may have charged. And he's also going to get hit with a chargeback fee, which, to my way of thinking, is nothing more than being fined for being the victim of a fraud.
Well, given the increase in identity theft and scams and the fraudulent use of credit cards, what are some of the things businesses that accept plastic need to be most wary of?
Well, there's a lot of things, Rick, and you know, I cover a lot of it in our website at merchant911.org, but many of the things that need to be done are trying to do IP geolocation to find out the actual physical location where that order originated. Taking a look at the issuing bank, the first six numbers of the credit card or the what we call the BIN, the bank identification number, mm-hmm. trying to determine where that bank is and kind of work with those two and cross-reference them to see if they're in the same general area. That doesn't always tell a tale. Many times the IP addresses will show that the order originated in Indonesia or Germany or something like that, and they're asking you to ship to a U.S. address, and that's a really, really big red flag. Some of the other things that merchants can do, is to call the issuing bank. There are some services out there that claim to do callback to the person that's initiating the order. And unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, these are nothing but a ripoff to the merchant. And in fact, if you go to our blog, there's the most recent posting is about one of these services who claims to be able to slash credit card fraud by calling back the customer.
Yeah, I read that. I read that just the other day. I found that very interesting.
Yeah, but you know what? If I'm a bad guy and I'm trying to scam a merchant with a stolen credit card, I'm going to give him my disposable cell phone number, and he's going to call me, and I'm going to verify everything that that he asked me. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, these services do nothing but sell a merchant a false sense of security. Mm-hmm. But certainly calling the issuing bank and verifying the shipping address with the bill to address and possibly verifying the telephone number of the customer and then calling the customer on that bank verified phone number. These are all very good steps. And unfortunately, everybody has to make their own decision as to what they want to do. And a lot depends on the volume that you're doing and the amount of the transaction. You know, we have merchants in Merchant 911 that are doing 50,000-100,000 transactions a month. They can't obviously call every potential customer.
Sure, that isn't really possible.
No. So there are automated systems that are out there. Some of them are better than others, and I certainly don't recommend one over the other. But you have to kind of do your homework before you start paying these people to do this. But for the small merchant just starting out, as far as I'm concerned, there's no better way to do it than to do your own fraud screening.
Well, given that there are the scammers on one side and then the credit card companies and the processing companies on the other side to watch out for, it would seem that the merchant is pretty much caught in the middle. And in the end, they're really having to sort through everything. I mean, as far as choosing a merchant, if they want to do it. And let me say right here to all my listeners that I'm not discouraging the use of credit cards. In fact, I'm one who, you know, who accepts credit cards. And I found that, you know, if I didn't accept credit cards online and on site, I would lose a lot of that business that I have right now. It would make it a little more difficult for me. So it's a matter of necessity for me to accept them in a lot of circumstances. I'm not discouraging the acceptance or anyone looking at accepting credit cards. You know, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying that be careful. And there's a lot to watch out for when you're going to do it. There's a lot to consider here. One of the things that I had to consider was which credit cards to accept, because not all of them pay in a timely manner and not all of them are easy to deal with. There were a couple that I had to cut out, as a matter of fact, because I had a lot of trouble with getting payments from them on time and when I had issues with them getting any kind of cooperation. In your opinion, Tom, what is the most merchant unfriendly card out there based on your experience?
Well, probably I would have to say American Express. Their fees are higher. And the other thing is that when you deal with American Express, you are dealing directly with them. You're not dealing with issuing banks or anything else. And we don't accept them in my business. We accept Visa, MasterCard, and Discover. Discover typically charges a slightly higher rate normally, but again, they're much easier to deal with generally than the other two are. Mm-hmm. Visa, obviously, you've got to take it. They have probably 70% or 80% of the market. Anybody's going to have a Visa card. A lot of people don't have MasterCards. Very few people have Discover or American Express. Mm-hmm. But definitely, American Express is one that you've got to weigh very carefully before you make the decision to accept it.
Well, American Express, as a matter of fact, is one of the two cards that I did cut out. As a matter of fact, it was the first one that I let go, that I fired, I like to say fired. And they did give me a hard time. They're very, very tough to deal with. It's well known that they are tough because some of my customers would come in when I did accept them and would hand it to me almost apologetically and say, look, all I have here is my American Express card. I'm sorry, but that's the only one I've got on me right now. Will you take this one? Because they knew. They knew it was a problem, that they have that reputation. Discover, I cut them out too, just because they were very, very slow to pay.
Yeah, well, I think, Rick, a lot of that might have to do with the processor too. Different processors go through different contortions before you get the money. So that I think that is as much processor dependent, although obviously they can't get their money until they get it from the credit card company. And again, like I said, you're not dealing with issuing banks there. You're dealing directly with the company. Visa and MasterCard, a lot of people don't realize this, but they are not card issuers. They are merely an organization of issuing banks and processors that get together and offer this service through the issuing bank. But the issuing banks actually are the ones that issue the credit cards. Whereas with Discover and American Express, they actually issue that card and do their own processing.
Well, among these cards, which card, if any of them, is the easiest for the merchants to deal with?
I don't know that I could say one over the other particularly. As you said, Discover's a little bit slow to pay, but I haven't had any really bad issues with them. Visa, MasterCard, you know, if you're going to take a credit card, you're probably going to take both of those, and you have to live with whatever they throw at you. So I don't know that I could recommend one over the other, but again, like I said, the American Express certainly is one that you've got to think over very carefully before you issue that card, or accept that card, rather.
In our next episode, we're going to continue our discussion with Tom and hear more about credit card merchant accounts. He will tell us how to shop around when setting up a merchant account, what you can do to minimize the risk of a chargeback on a credit card transaction, and how you can use the tools on his website to protect yourself and your business from credit card fraud. As we conclude with part two of our two-part series on Merchant 911, Accepting Credit Cards. Well, folks, our time is up. I would like to thank everyone for listening, my kids for allowing me to do this without interruptions, and my wife for just putting up with me. If you would like to comment on the program, you can email me at rick@theforcefield.net or visit our website at www.theforcefield.net. Opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not represent The Force Field, Savoia Computer, or advertisers. All music on the show is original and was written and performed by Brother Rancid and the Brand New Pygmies. Our announcer is Felix DeCat. The show is produced and distributed by Savoia Computer. For The Force Field, I'm Rick Savoia. May the force field be with you.